I'm Matt Reed, Director of the Countryside and Community Research Institute at the University of Gloucestershire, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the CCRI podcast. We'll be taking you behind the scenes of our research, revealing the day-to-day life of our internationally excellent research institute. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another CCRI podcast. I'm Daniel Keach, and today we're going to talk about what it's like to be a postgraduate at the CCRI. We've got a pretty small cohort of postgraduates at the institute, 11 at the time of this recording, but actually that's about a quarter of our complement. So it's important to emphasise that postgraduates make up a very significant and valued part of our team. We're joined by two postgraduates today in this conversation, Josh Davis and Annie Buckle, who are in their second year of their PhDs with us. And Annie, let's start with you. Welcome to the podcast. Would you please introduce yourself and say something about your background and how you came about the decision of trying to embark on a PhD?
Thanks, Dan, and thanks for having me on as well. I'm Annie Buckle. I'm just coming to my second year of my PhD. I am a mature student of almost 37, and I went through the conventional school, left school, went to university, but then I spent about 10 years in horticulture doing various different things, and decided to come back to education, did an undergraduate degree in biological sciences, went straight on to a master's in sustainable agriculture and food security, and then I've managed to win myself this fantastic position with the CCRI as a PhD candidate.
Great, thank you. Can we just dwell a tiny bit on that? You were saying you're a mature student, you did a university degree first and worked in horticulture for 10 years, but then, did I understand right, you did a second degree?
I did, yes.
So you really...
I now have two undergraduate degrees and two masters.
Right. Oh, my gracious. So do you think maybe there's something going on here about the unwillingness to leave education, possibly?
Yes. Okay. I want to be an eternal student.
Okay. We'll
never pay taxes.
We'll see what we can do. Thank you very much, Annie. Josh, would you like to introduce yourself a bit as well and tell us a bit about your background and what brought you here?
Yeah. Hi, Dan. And Annie, nice to be here, and thanks for having me on. I'm a Welsh PhD student. I'm also in my second year. I joined the same time as Annie, although, you know, every journey is slightly different, so paths have diverged a little bit now. Not so mature, 24 years old, and I guess I've followed the more conventional academic route in moving from undergraduate degree and through master's at the University of Bristol, and then straight into PhD. Pretty much rapid fire, minus about 6 months of mulling over decisions and deciding what it is that I kind of wanted to lend my time and some talents to. Like Annie, I've worked alongside A-level and kind of university studies, both for the universities themselves, be it peer mentoring and kind of like assisted study sessions, and then also beyond, I've worked in a toy store alongside academic pursuits. I guess in terms of what led me here, one is change, but then also the research institutes are kind of aligned with my personal interests. I found in looking at PhD programs somewhat tentatively initially, I struggled to find the funded opportunity here and there to do things that really interested me and that I felt I would be both kind of qualified and engaged with. Then in finding the CCRI, I found whole research priority areas that were aligned to my interests, as opposed to kind of scraping the barrel to find something that might be adjacent or tagged on to a broader program.
Thanks, Josh. Unlike Annie, who's taken a slower route towards starting her PhD, you've described how you've come straight through. Annie's journey does have a clear logic to it, even though it's been more meandering, let's say. What about yours? Tell us about your undergraduate and initial postgraduate experiences. How do they tie up with how you've got to here?
Yeah, so I guess in many ways it's the kind of slow move from kind of natural science into the social science domain. So my undergraduate was just straight biological sciences. And then my master's was integrated within that. And that's when I kind of first was not introduced to social science methodologies and context, but was the first opportunity for me to kind of turn my study subject inward and start to look at humans as a principal source within that. So the work that I was centered on there was all to do with consumer perceptions surrounding aquaponics and other sustainable methods of food production. So then when finding the kind of initial advertisement for this position, I thought that there was a kind of natural segue, but then also allowed me to focus on some kind of principal research interests around in rewilding and nature recovery and the like.
Great. Let's come back to that in just a second with the next question, but I want to turn to Annie first. Can you just tell me what really is your study about? What are you researching in your PhD program?
The sort of title, if that's the easiest way to explain it, is identifying and communicating optimal grazing management for sustainable farming. And it's essentially looking at how and why farmers want to sort of care for their soils and their grasslands above and beyond just livestock production, essentially. So, you know, there's an awful lot of research going into the most sustainable food production that we can sort of achieve. But that research is only as good as the practice that comes out of it. So translating all that wonderful scientific evidence, etc., into practice, that's sort of where I'm going with this, to see what is getting through to farmers on the ground who have to make these decisions every single day, all sorts of different decisions every single day about their farming, about their management practices, etc. And, you know, they've got, as we do in our everyday lives, many different things to think about, many different priorities to make. So I'm looking specifically at those who are prioritising their sort of soil and grassland health and seeing why it is that they're making that a priority.
Great, thank you very much. Josh, can I ask you the same question? Can you describe what your PhD is about?
Yeah, sure. So I often find in these questions is when you realise how difficult it is to communicate your research interest.
Yep.
It's an elevator pitch of sorts, isn't it? But I guess the broad remit is skills acquisition and development for nature-based recovery. And that's alongside some legacy projects, looking more broadly at delivering landscape change, best practice stakeholder and public engagement in landscape scale environmental decision making and the like. I think in terms of the context of that, I see UK agriculture and more broadly land use and natural resource management at a time of change, and it's really evolving, you know, driven in part by change in societal demands, but then also increased efforts to champion agri-environmental practices. As such, social science research is needed to scale this nature-based recovery, really centered on kind of an understanding and appreciation of human capital required in delivering this transition to environmental land management schemes, natural capital payments, etc. This research specifically aims to explore the environmental, collaborative, digital and entrepreneurial skills that are required by practitioners in this shift towards landscape scale recovery.
You both described a close need to engage with practitioners, farmers basically, and other types of land managers in what appears to be a really very urgent problem caused by climate change, but also maybe one that rubs up against the time-honoured traditions involved in looking after landscapes. And particularly, Josh, I know you're interested in this concept of cultural landscapes. Excuse me. So I wondered if you could say anything about how you're finding the experience of this challenge, both of you. How have you found your engagement with constituents, if you like, the farmers and the land managers? How are they coping with these difficult times?
Sure. It's a weighted question. And I think part of the reason for that is that land use and management remain really contentious issues. In turn, defining and achieving any form of sustainability amongst this kind of backdrop of complexity, multi-scale and continually evolving systems represents a challenge, both for research practitioners, but then also policymakers and the like. I think part of that issue lies in that there's no real one-size-fits-all model for success, and often agri-environment schemes have been tailored towards a kind of prescriptive maintenance and tick box activity. I think more and more now we're seeing that outcomes will vary given scale and then regional, biophysical, economic, sociocultural, and then also personal environments, you know, as well as the wide-ranging dispositions and identities of the people that are really being engaged with it. As such, ensuring any kind of just transition towards environmental land management, it remains a balancing act, both in maximizing the kind of natural and social capital of current farming practices, but then also preventing unacceptable trade-offs between the future potential for restoration and the current productivity of the land. And I think, you know, being Welsh, I've seen quite close to home the kind of polarized views that the rewilding movement has generated in terms of the links to neocolonialism and so forth. So I think part of the role as a researcher isn't to try and position myself as best as possible to articulate practitioners' opinions in a way that is authentic to them, as opposed to perhaps maybe in the past asking for opinions and then being the one that then shares them to the world as not quite in as authentic a way, I guess.
Great. Thank you. So you're sort of reflecting the complexity rather than trying to iron your way through it. Annie, how about you? How have you found this difficult challenge that you're facing?
I haven't actually found it very difficult. I've been really excited and really encouraged by the people that I've met. I've got a fantastic group of farmers that I've been working with. I worked with them during my master's degree, and they're actually the reason, pretty much, along with quite a few significant other people, why I'm able to do this PhD. And they are just the most fantastic people that I've met, and they are really encouraging in what they were trying to achieve. They almost take not unnecessary risks, but they're willing to take almost any risk within reason to care for their land. And I say it's their land because they are the ones that are caring for it. They're the ones that are having to make decisions about it. And even going on farm walks with some of them, they talk about their different fields like their friends, or, you know, oh, she's always flooding, can't ever use her until the summer, and, you know, this one over here, and they know their land. It's part of them almost. And so it's just really, like I say, it's just really encouraging to meet all of these people. And, you know, even if I just speak to a couple of farmers at a conference, so I'm not even working with them or been to their land or anything like that, they've got so much enthusiasm for what they're doing, but also at the same time, which is why I'm so looking forward to doing this research, and it's I'm really excited about it. They're so frustrated as well because they're so desperate to do the right thing, but it's knowing what the right thing is and how they know when they're doing the right thing, if they're doing the right thing. And I'm seeing just a huge amount of collaboration between them all as well. And compared to my original view or possible assumptions, I never try to assume anything on and you know about people. It's just completely different to what I thought. You know, you sort of are told that farmers are destroying the environment and they're destroying the land, and you know they're just these awful people, and they're not. They feed us. Like, they are the reason that we have food, and they're just these incredible people who I would never. I've had some pretty tough jobs in my lifetime, in my slightly longer lifetime than Josh, and I would never want to be a farmer because it's so hard, it's so tough. They're not doing it 9 to 5, they are doing it 24/7, 365 days a year. There's no time off for them. Even when they go away on holiday, you know, if they go away on holiday, they're still thinking about it. They're still worrying about it, and they care so much. And that's the thing that I just, yeah, it's incredible to see. Really encouraging.
Have you had any nice experiences, amusing experiences, unexpected experiences in doing field work, for example, that you'd like to share?
Well, so far, my experience of field work is from my master's, but as I say, still working with the same group of farmers. And I did my research alongside a fellow master's student, and we had just the best time doing it. It was just a catalogue of errors almost. And we were very kindly put up by one of the farmers in this beautiful barn, and we spent the days trekking around all these different fields and, you know, driving into these fields trying to get back out again. Luckily I've got a 4x4, so that's fine. And you know, it was, we should have catalogued the amount of gates that we went through. So it sounds very weird and very niche, but all the different ways that farmers find to tie up their gates or do up their gates, or how you undo them, like some of them are latches, some of them are baler twine, some of them you lift and push, some of them you just kick. And we never went through the same gate twice, which was hilarious. So that sounds like a very, yeah, like I say, very niche thing, but it's just we got driven around by one of our farmers as well on the back of the quad bike. And he clearly forgot he was holding onto handlebars and we were holding onto nothing. He's trying to hold onto all of our equipment with one hand and holding onto the quad bike with the other and all this stuff. It was fantastic experience, really fun. We did it in the middle of a heat wave. Like I say, it was just, yeah, brilliant. I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Well done. Thank you.
Ups and downs of PhD researcher.
How about you, Josh? Have you gotten into field work yet? Have you had any memorable experiences?
Yeah, so I've been fortunate to be involved in kind of research internship alongside the PhD, and then also now some bids and tenders. And I think looking back to last summer, myself and my supervisors, who kind of formed the steering group on this particular project, went up to Lincoln for a site visit, and we went out in an electric vehicle aptly named the Beast, but it was probably limited to a max speed of about 20 miles an hour. And at the time in which we went, it just so happened that the singular road that kind of intersects the entire bounds of, and perimeter of the site was being resurfaced. So we had to get out continuously to move like safety bollards, etc., and drive past a series of very serious looking workmen, all with our like safety protective equipment on, whilst driving in this electric buggy to go off and see the site. But that makes it seem as though field work is a lot of driving around. But
thank you very much. Let's talk a bit more about life in general as a PhD student. How do you find it in general? What are you explained many of the joys already, zooming around the countryside, holding on to farmers' wastes, including some of them. What about the other stuff? How is it doing a PhD? What's it like? What do you get up to?
Yeah, I think it would be disingenuous not to then turn to kind of discuss some of the more negative aspects associated with PhD research. But I guess the caveat there is that every journey is so individualistic that it's hard then to draw comparisons, and you know, social media can be both a great tool but also a dark place when people are often the negative voices shout the loudest. I think for me, one of the big takeaways is finding how you work best early on and then sticking to that. I know a few people that quite staunchly advocate for treating the PhD as a 9-to-5 job, whereas someone like myself, who works quite well early in the morning and late at evening, would struggle to adapt to that system. And whilst it's great to do so when it suits you, also in the long run I might put myself more at risk of burnout or adapting to a schedule that doesn't quite suit myself as much. And then also I think the broader kind of subject of life work or work life balance, it's easy to, as you said, when you're in the throes of theorizing alone at night in a room, it's quite hard to then zoom out and balance that kind of academic progress with life and the importance of both taking time and breaks to switch off and recharge. I think to that end, you know, something that I often come back to is that you're a lot more than the sum of your PhD.
Thank you. Annie?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I often try to explain it to people that, especially any listeners who are currently doing undergraduate degrees or master's degrees, I would try and compare doing a PhD to doing one assignment. So if you're anything like me, say you have 3 months to do an assignment, you spend the first month, you know, thinking about it and trying to understand what it is that you're doing and maybe chatting to your friends like, well, what are you doing? How are you doing it? You then spend the second month doing, you know, some more in-depth research and really try and sort of, you know, knuckle down on what you're doing. And then spend the last week, I meant month, actually producing your assignment, and now stretch that 3 months out over 3 years. The first year that I've just done, I have found extremely difficult because I really struggled to focus my attention on what I was doing. So sort of going back to what Josh was saying at the beginning, where he was struggling to find something that he was like really, really interested in, invested in, I almost went the complete opposite way. And my brain just exploded with ideas. And I was just like, oh, I could do this and I could do that. And oh, what about that? Oh, that's really interesting. And so, you know, even just reading anything online or any books or research papers, I just couldn't finish reading anything because I was just like, oh, that's a really good idea. I'll go and look at that and I'll go and look at that and I'll go and look at that. And I kept having to remind myself what it is that I was doing and reminding myself that what I was doing was just as good as all the other things that I was seeing that other people were doing. And so I was almost looking at other people's going, oh, I wish I was doing that instead. That looks really good. And then when I reminded myself of what I was actually doing, I was like, no, what I am doing is also really cool. So yeah, that entire year of trying desperately to control it's a good thing, my enthusiasm for what I was doing and my excitement for what I was doing, but it has been extremely difficult. And again, touching on what Josh was saying about trying to trying to focus your work ethics as well. Again, I have I've been in a professional working environment for 10 years or so. So I don't have a lack of understanding of how I work and that, you know, I am one of these people that wanted to treat it as a 9-to-5 job because that's what I'm used to. But this last year has been a lot more thinking and reading and things as opposed to actually producing anything, which again, I found very difficult being in industry. You produce things, you don't just think about things. So again, I found that quite difficult. So I've been working through lots of different ways of understanding how I work as well. I've worked with a coach as well to see if what I'm doing is producing what I want to produce, if it's the best, most effective way to do things, and trialing lots of different, just trial and error really, and being kind to yourself and knowing that it's okay to trial a bit. And if you haven't done what you thought you were going to do, then looking at other things that you did do which you didn't expect to do, etc.
If I might just very, very briefly add my own personal experiences, I was 41 when I started my PhD and had a 6-month-old baby, my third.
Wow.
And I, you know, echoes a bit what you were saying, Josh, about, you know, being able to find a way to fit studying into the life that you live. And I found it the perfect time. And I can't imagine that I'd have ever had the discipline or the circumstances to do a PhD apart from at that time in my life, maybe. Maybe we could move now into things like that you ended up talking about, you know, the idea of not having people you're sitting next to habitually to talk to, finding help. What are the support systems that you've got?
Whoever will have me. I am extremely fortunate that I have very tolerant family and friends. So I have a really, really good, strong support network with my family and friends. And I've sort of identified them to use them in different ways. So if I just need like a shoulder to cry, I don't know what I'm doing, then I go to one person. If I need to just talk and not be interrupted, I go to another person. So I use, this sounds awful, I use my friends and family. I use them in different ways. Unbelievable. They've just been invaluable as a support system. And I'm also incredibly lucky that the company that I used to work for, I still do a little bit of work for, invited me back in to work in their offices. So I just had a hot desk there that I can do my own work at, but I'm surrounded by people. I'm surrounded by my old work colleagues and friends. So I have that support network as well. Just I don't have to talk to them, but I just know that they're there. There's just a bit of noise and, you know, you can just have a little break and have a little chat and then go back to it. And it just feels more normal, right. More what I'm used to. Okay. And it just makes me feel a little bit more human, because me and having conversations with the dog was probably not the healthiest for my mind. Probably the most important people for your PhD is your supervisor. And something that I kept seeing, reading and being told before I started was, make sure you pick the right supervisor because you're going to be working together for the next 4 years. And I thought, how do you know what your supervisor's like until you start working with them? And I am extremely fortunate, I would say. Well, Josh and I have the same supervisors, but they are fantastic. They, again, as I was saying earlier, they both have different strengths in different areas. So it's really nice to work with both of them, to have those two different sort of dynamics at play almost. I spent, like I say, the last year, because I was a bit all over the place, I was, I'm not scared to admit it, I was a little bit scared or worried each time I had a supervisor meeting, because I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't got anything to show, or, you know, I haven't done what I thought I was going to do, and they're gonna think that I'm not working or that I'm not interested or anything like that. So I almost sort of avoided them in a way, and it got to the point where I just thought, this is silly. Like, you know, they're there to help me. They're not, you know, if I fail, it's my own failure. It's not sort of their failure or anything like that. And I arranged a meeting with them, and I was just really open and honest with them. And I just said, look, I've been struggling. I found it really difficult. This is what, you know, I had this whole speech prepared basically about how I'd been struggling, and that I really wanted to prove that I was committed. There was no question that I was going to do this and I wanted to do it. And my supervisor cut me off almost sort of second sentence in and said, Annie, this is fine. You're doing fine. We're not worried about you. We're always here if you need it. You know, thank you for coming and telling and talking to us and stuff. Please come in more often. We want to see more of you. Come into the office. You don't have to, you know, come into the office just for a meeting. Just come in the office. Be with us. It'd be so nice to see you again. And I thought, it just reminded me, stupidly, because I'd forgotten, that I am part of this community, the CCRI. It's lovely to just walk in the office and, you know, sit down and have a chat with someone. And it's fantastic. And I almost forgot that when I was just sitting at home on my own thinking, oh, I'm really lonely and I don't know who to talk to. Duh, I've got all of you guys to talk to.
Lucky us, eh?
Before we go moving on to you, Josh, let me just emphasise quickly for listeners that the PhDs we've got at the CCRI generally tend to be externally funded. So the colleagues putting them together with partners from, you know, the non-academic world generally will be trying to compete against other bidders to research budgets and will be trying their best to make a complementary team. But it also means that often there is some kind of applied aspect to the PhD study route that gives us a non-academic support system in the supervision as well. Josh, how about you? How have you found it at CCRI?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, as we've mentioned, supervision and oversight is such a key part of this process. And I think Annie's touched on a really interesting point about the kind of the initial reaction born out of a place of, be it kind of, there's a little bit of imposter syndrome creeps in, so the impulse is to want to hide away from that and to avoid those kind of conversations. But I think the takeaway there is the importance of kind of fostering open communication and setting realistic targets, but then also kind of fostering mutual trust and respect with that, and equally opening yourself up to the more human side of that supervisory relationship. They're such a key part of the journey and instrumental in its success and failure, but also they're humans too, with demands on their time. And, you know, more and more I'm seeing that whilst my research and my objectives are the entirety of my world, they're not for other people. And it's about kind of balancing that. But then also that's where having such a close-knit research community within the CCRI is so helpful, and the kind of early involvement within bids and tenders and resulting projects if you wanted, but then also kind of that valued expertise and contacts that come with it. I'm very fortunate and do find myself fanboying every now and again over some incredibly talented and well-respected people that I can sit down to and have conversations with and are treated as an equal within that space. And that's something that I don't take for granted.
Josh and I went to the Agile Initiative with the Oxford University, where one of the old students is part of at the moment. And it was a fantastic experience. It was really good. So, yeah, I think that's, again, like I say, a compliment to the CCRI that you're still fostering those connections as well.
Thank you for mentioning that. It gives me an opportunity to just quickly mention that for many, many years, we've run the CCRI winter or summer school, depending on when in the year it happens, of course. And I remember going to a CCRI winter school, I think in 2011, when I was a student, and now Amy and I are co-organising our third one this year. So it's lovely to see that going strong and keeping our connections going.
And outside the university, outside the research institute.
Yes, yeah. we've had foreign students coming for the first time this year.
Exciting.
Let's begin to wind up by talking about life after. What are your career aspirations, maybe, or just life aspirations, and how do you think that the PhD will inform them?
I'll let you go first, Josh.
Well, saving the best till last, yeah. I think I remember in my initial kind of interview for the PhD, when asked why I wanted to do one, I mentioned increased research autonomy, enthusiasm and interest, and longer term career goals. But I was keen to caveat that with, whilst I could see myself in a future in academia, I'm also quite privy to the transferable skills that a PhD would generate if I then moved off and either went into to kind of industry or was able to go into consultancy or NGO, etc. My aim then is to kind of, regardless to where I end up, continue to have that enthusiasm and interest for the research subject. And that's something that, whilst the format of my occupation might vary, I think my kind of passion for dealing with these issues probably won't, and it'll be quite hard to diminish that. So the hope is that I can make my way through this process and kind of maintain that enthusiasm for wanting to tackle these issues, be it in a academic or professional capacity.
Great, thank you very much. Annie, how about you?
I have never been a planner. I sort of have tended to sail through life picking at things that I find interesting at the time. This opportunity has been, or is currently, just really exciting. And I've not really experienced something that I've really wanted to get my teeth into so much. And food production for me, agriculture, etc., is something that you can literally talk to anyone about, because everybody eats food, everybody has an opinion. And in my experience of working in different industries or different types of industries, I haven't come across one that is so universal, and that's what I find quite exciting. So it might be that I carry on with academia. It might be, like Josh says, I might go into industry. I might do my own research. I might go and buy a farm. Probably not, because farming is really hard
and expensive.
But I don't know what I'm going to be doing. But I do know that I'm really excited about what the potential is. And in a way, that's what this PhD has opened up for me, or what any kind of education has opened up for me. And so the fact that I have got this far is so exciting, and it's just opening up lots of doors and things like that, which, like I say, is just, it's very uplifting, very exciting.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I will just end maybe by saying that we've been hearing from Josh and Annie about their studies that are particularly linked to land management issues. I wanted just to say that our PhD cohort and master's cohort as well at the CCRI have got interests in environmental governance, in aspects of cultural geography, forestry, fisheries, and in some cases urban studies, in alliance with our colleagues in other departments in the university. So let's close it there, and thank you very much, Josh and Annie, for sharing your experiences and thoughts with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having us.
Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thanks for listening to the CCRI podcast. You can find more information on the Countryside and Community Research Institute at the University of Gloucestershire in the show notes or at www.ccri.ac.uk. See you next time.